live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be exploring a vital nutrient that is a key in keeping your body's internal clocks running on time, University of Edinburgh. More exposure to vegetation is linked with lower death rates in women, Harvard School of Public Health. Mushrooms boost immunity, University of Florida Institute for Food and Agricultural Sciences. Wow, could a mushroom a day keep the doctor away? This says yes, and I'll tell you which mushrooms. Vitamin D helps reduce childhood allergy rate, University of Auckland, New Zealand. And watering your garden with city water injects pharmaceuticals into your veggies, the American Chemical Society. And add nature, art, and religion to life's best anti-inflammatories, University of Toronto, and more on health and healing. And my guest in the second part of our program, talking about the crisis humanity faces with the rise of sadistic fascist capitalism, is Professor William Robinson. He is a professor of sociology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is also the university's faculty of Latin American Studies, and is the Global and International Studies Program Director. He himself is a scholar activist. In fact, he took a sabbatical recently to travel around the world to see exactly how people were living and what impact globalization and transnationalism and neoliberalism was having on it. This will be an interesting discussion, so you won't want to miss that. And by the way, I have coming up Vandana Shiva. She'll be on our next program. So we have a really packed program today. Also bringing into our discussion with Professor Robinson a new report on Palestinian children and Israel's military detention experiences, violence, coarse confessions, and nothing is being done about it. Let's begin. We always begin with the latest on health and healing. And in this case, we're dealing with a nutrient. According to the latest research from the University of Edinburgh in Scotland, this essential mineral in our diets has an unexpected role in helping living things remain adapted to the rhythms of night and day, and that is magnesium. It's a nutrient found in many foods. It helps control how cells keep their own form of time to cope with natural environmental cycles of day and night. And the discovery in cells is expected to be linked to whole body clocks, which influence daily cycles, or what we call circadian rhythms of sleeping and waking, hormone releases, your body temperature, and other important bodily functions. That's one of the reasons that when I'm helping people who may have underactive thyroids, I find that magnesium is extremely beneficial. Also, there's a special type of magnesium, not your normal magnesium. It's a special magnesium that impacts the brain, can help people with dementia and Alzheimer's. So in this case, they found that experiments in three major types of biological organisms, human cells and algae and fungi, found in each case that levels of magnesium in cells rise and fall in a daily cycle. So when you take your magnesium also matters. I suggest that you take it in the morning and you take it in the evening, and therefore you have a better biological clock. And this was published in the Nature magazine and was done by the Royal Society and the Medical Research Council. So what happens if you don't have enough magnesium? Well, you might not go to sleep on time. You might be tired when you wake up in the morning. You might find that in the middle of the day you're just kind of dragging. That's the impact of your biological clock. Recently, I've read at least three separate papers that talk about how we heal better, are more relaxed, and are more clear when we're in nature. This is just the latest, and this is from Harvard School of Public Health. Women in the United States who live in homes surrounded by more vegetation appear to have significantly lower death rates than those who live in areas with less vegetation. That's according to this latest study by the Harvard Chan School of Public Health and Brigham and Women's Hospital. The study found that women who lived in the greenest surroundings had a really big 12% lower overall death rate than those living in homes or apartments. So for all the people who've been making moves to the cities, and they are, a good example would be San Francisco. And these are generally younger people, and they're paying astronomical rents. If they can afford to buy, it's at least 300 to 400% higher than it was just about 10 years ago. So it's a massive bubble out there, but they have a booming economy in the Silicon Valley, and they employ tens of thousands of people. Now these people are wanting to be where the action is. Interesting, I'll tell you a little story. I was in San Francisco, when I was last in San Francisco, I was on tour, and the publishers, all publishers, will have a driver, because after all, an author doesn't know the cities, doesn't know how to get in quickest to the different locations, and you're packed. There's not a second available. In fact, they ask you before you go, do you want something to eat? And because you're not going to have time all day, you're 15, 18 hours. And it might be for 2 or 3 days. So I got in the car with this gentleman, and after 2 or 3 stops that he took me to, he started a conversation. He said, well, you know, I've read some of your books, and we try to follow a healthy lifestyle. And I said, oh. I said, what did you do before you became a driver? He said, I was an author. I said, really? He said, yeah, I published some books. I had a couple very popular selling books, and then things changed in publishing, interest changed, editors change. And I said, I can understand what you're saying, because every time I've had monster bestsellers, Doubleday, Broadway Books, Dell, and New American Library, all the big publishing houses, I have monster hits. When my editor leaves, I always leave, because the next person coming in, they're not going to be in alignment, they're not going to harmonize with you, and though contractually they have to publish your books, you don't get the tours, you don't get the publicity, you don't get that word out, and hence you don't have that success anymore. And so I always leave. And he said, well, I tried, but didn't work. And I said, so what happened? He said, well, we couldn't afford to live here anymore. My wife and I have lived here in San Francisco for 20 years. But then when the Silicon Valley boom happened, all these young people came in, and the market went through the roof. So we have to live an hour and 20 minutes away. I say, so every day you commute, he's about an hour and a half every day. So 3 hours a day you're commuting because you can't afford to live there. I said, you know, you're not alone. I found the same thing with people living in Santa Fe and in Taos, and it becomes very popular. Baby boomers come in, they gentrify the whole area, and then the locals can't afford to live there. Now, I share this with you because right now, there's a movement in New York to get what would be considered a closet made into an apartment. Tiny little spaces, 200 square feet. I mean, you can touch the walls if you hold your arms out. And yet, there's a greater demand, demand than there is a supply. Well, where's your green there? Where's your nature? We don't have it. If you go to Central Park, you can get some. If you go to Riverside Park and some of the other parks around New York, Prospect Park, these are all beautiful parks. But you have to go there, and a lot of times people are too busy to do it. So what this study is showing is, for those of you who have grass and trees and shrubs and flowers where you live, you're going to live a longer life if you're a woman. And that's a big difference. Or put another way, do you ever think about how much of your life you're giving up, surrendering, because of what you think you have to live or need to live in order to succeed? Just something to think about. And this was published in Environmental Health Perspectives. Now, this is good news for those who like mushrooms. And this is the University of Florida Institute for Food and Agricultural Science. Quote, could a mushroom a day keep the doctor away? A new University of Florida study shows increased immunity in people who ate a cocktail of shiitake mushroom every day for 4 weeks. Wow. Quote, of the thousands of mushroom species globally, about 20 are used culinary purposes. Shiitake mushrooms are native to Asia and are cultivated for their culinary and medicinal value. And this was a study they did to show that in people who consumed these mushrooms for 4 weeks, there was a big improvement in their overall immune system. Quote, if you eat a shiitake mushroom every day, you could see changes in your immune system that are beneficial. This was one of the heads of the study. Quote, we're enhancing the immune system, but we're also reducing inflammation that the immune system produces. So you're enhancing immunity, you're reducing inflammation. That's exactly what we want to do every day, because that helps prevent diseases. Now, it doesn't tell you in this study what causes inflammation, but you already know that. Air pollution, water pollution, stress, heavy metals in canned goods, many of the medications people take, alcohol, all your fried foods, your animal products, your refined carbohydrates and sugars, artificial sweeteners, coffee, that's what causes inflammation. But if you have someone who's not going to change, and let's be realistic, most people don't change. I could never get anyone in my own family to change, and I had a huge family. So when you consider my father's brothers and sisters, my mother's brothers and sisters, there's like 18 all told. Nobody ever changed. They never stopped smoking, and some would smoke 3 packs, 4 packs a day. They'd drink, they would eat meat and sugar galore, they'd have desserts even though they had a full meal. They never exercised, and of course they all died young and thought that that was normal. Quote, well, you'd hear this at the funerals. Well, their number was up, but they lived a good life. They were 58 years old. How is that a good life? That's not a good life. You know, 108, that's a good life. And I couldn't get them because I was considered that odd person that went to New York instead of working in the OAM shovel factory. And trying to talk about a salad. Oh, we eat salads. No, you eat iceberg lettuce and a tasteless tomato that, well, if you ate cardboard and the tomato, you would know which was which. And there's no nutrition in iceberg lettuce. But that's what they did. So now, let's say you have, as I do, friends, and by the way, all of my friends, with two exceptions, are unhealthy. But it's not my right, and I must respect that boundary, to never talk about health around them. That's the rules. And I don't. You know? And so I'm, wherever we eat out, I'm eating something healthy, they're eating something not. They like what they're eating, I like what I'm eating. The difference is, there's a whole lot of bad going on in their body. But that's their choice. At the end of the day, even foolish choices that are going to lead to a bad outcome, you must respect the person's right to make them if they're smart enough to know what they're doing. And so now we're reading in the Journal of the American College of Nutrition that these shiitake mushrooms are building our immune system, turning off inflammation. So I would try to get mushrooms into a person. It's not going to change otherwise, to at least to allow some modification. It's just like if I can get vitamin C into someone who otherwise wouldn't be taking it, it will make a little difference. Now, it's not going to revolutionize everything, but it'll make some difference. So the key is get your mushrooms, because this is talking about how important and powerful they are. Quote, if you listen again, if you eat a shiitake mushroom every day, you could see changes in the immune system that are beneficial. We're enhancing the immune system, and we're also reducing the inflammation that the immune system produces. So get your mushrooms. Now, vitamin D, which we also should be getting every day, can reduce childhood allergy rate. This from the University of Auckland in New Zealand, quote, vitamin D supplements during pregnancy and infancy may help reduce high childhood allergy rate. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Allergy. So most people are deficient in vitamin D. So get your vitamin D every day. And watering your garden with City Water injects pharmaceuticals into your veggies. Quote, do you water your vegetable garden with recycled City Water? Well, what comes out of the tap is water. If so, you may be eating pharmaceutical contaminants that accumulate in your food. A recent study by the American Chemical Society published in Chemistry and Engineering News shows that, quote, eating vegetables grown using our, water boost urine levels of anti-epileptic drugs and other drugs, and meaning that anyone who consumes this produce is exposed to the drugs that ended up in the water. The drug can enter the water in multiple ways, from drain disposal and unused medications and excretion through the urinary tract. Remember, everyone who consumes any drug, AZT or tranquilizers or statins, it's evacuated in the urine or feces that goes into the water supply. And there's no filtration system that is commercially available by cities to get rid of all that. With individual water filters, you can, but not with water out of a tap. I would never, I mean never, would I drink water out of a tap. It's sewer water. This is just one more study showing that now it goes onto your lawn, and then you end up eating vegetables that have got chemicals in them. And finally, University of Toronto, by taking in the Grand Canyon, the Sistine Chapel ceiling, or Schubert's Ave Maria, may give a boost to the body's defense system, according to New University of California researchers. Researchers have linked positive emotions, especially the awe we feel when touched by the beauty of nature and art and spirituality, with lower levels of pro-inflammatory cytokines, which this audience knows are proteins that signal the immune system to work harder. Quote, our findings demonstrate that positive emotions are associated with the markers of good health. And that was from the director of the study. This is what you need to know. You need to get yourself out and experience the wonders of life, the beauties of life. They're there, and they're terrific. When I hike up in the Grand Canyon, when I'm traveling, I'm always looking at those remarkable moments. Even this morning, I had a lot of traveling to do, so I had to get out and do my workout very early. And just as I was finished my workout, the sun was just rising, and the colors, the pinks and the light blues in the sky, I just stood there for a moment to say, just so magnificent. And that builds your whole immune system, a positive disposition. Put something positive in your mind. Stop being around whiners and complainers. People are always looking to blame everything on someone else. These are not people who are going to be a part of your positive immune system, and you should have zero tolerance for it. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to share some time and energy with you, everyone. By the way, a new person has come forward as a whistleblower to say that the CDC has been doing bad things when it comes to their autism studies. This is from Health Choice. Quote, the United States District Court for the District of Utah is preparing to hear critical motion from a former CDC researcher and whistleblower. Although the suit is directed primarily at the University of Utah, the whistleblower has alleged that the CDC's Autism and Developmental Disabilities Monitoring Network allowed research misconduct and persistent data errors in their autism prevalence report. The CDC Whistleblower allegations reveal serious concerns over the legitimacy and integrity of the CDC's management of its widely cited concerns in documents filed in federal court. The former principal investigator for Utah's network site, Judith Pinborough Zimmerman, asked for the right to a jury trial to adjudicate a range of claims against her employer, the University of Utah, with respect to her work as an autism researcher. According to the motion, Dr. Zimmerman was a successful university employee until she accused her supervisor, among others, of research misconduct and ethical misconduct. Defendants retaliated against Dr. Zimmerman for raising legal and ethical questions of employees' impropriety and took multiple adverse actions against her. Zimmerman's complaint includes specific concerns over alleged uncorrected errors in the CDC's autism analysis. So, once again, CDC manipulating data. And that is important to know. So we got another whistleblower out there. What can we do individually to make a difference in helping our environment? Think about this. There are two types of plastic. One that's a little more expensive, and most stores won't use it, but it biodegrades down. The other is a big problem. It could last for 1,000 years. That's correct, before it fully decomposes. Now, some of it will go to a landfill, yes, but more often than not, it ends up in the ocean. How much of it is there? China alone, 3 billion new plastic bags every 24 hours. 3 billion every 24 hours. That's what enters circulation. There's an area of the ocean called the Pacific Garbage Patch. It's large. It swirls, and as it swirls, the currents carry it, it collects. So it's massive. The smallest it could be would be about 270,000 square miles, about the size of Texas. But more accurately, it's about 5.8 million square miles. That's 8% of the size of the entire ocean. And what's being done about it? How about nothing? What can we do individually? The number one thing you can do to help save our environment is to eat less meat or stop it altogether, which is what I would recommend. Why? It's in the math. You don't have to love animals, as some of us do. You don't have to rescue animals, as many of us do. You don't have to respect life. Just be a pragmatist. Say, okay, give me a good reason, Gary, to stop my meat. Well, okay, beef produces about 30 kilograms of greenhouse gas per kilogram of food. That's beef. How about potatoes or carrots or rice? About 0.4 to, so that's huge. That's almost 60 times less if you're a vegan. That's correct. Why? Because it takes a lot of resources in order to keep an animal ready and let it grow to maturity so it can be consumed. How bad is it? For every steak that you eat, that animal is consuming about 1,800 gallons of water per steak. Not per animal, per steak. How about if I wanted, get my protein not from steak today, but from brown rice? Well, that's different. That's about 39 gallons. So let's measure it here. 1,800, 39. Pound of steak, 1,800. Pound of rice, 39. And so there should be a big movement now with all the films. I gave a sneak preview of a film not yet done. I showed only an hour and 8 minutes, going to be an hour and 40 minutes. So with all the books on vegetarianism, how many vegetarians do we have today? With all of our ads and all the celebrities and all the vegan restaurants and the cookbooks, we have 3.2%. That's about 7 million people. Or another way of looking at it, 97% of Americans are not vegan or vegetarian. By the way, vegans are only about 1%. And yet they do the greatest amount of good to protect the environment. So the question is twofold. Why does someone choose to become a vegan? And why does someone choose not to? If you know that the fate of the planet and global warming are the results of your choices, something to think about. There is a consequence to all that we do in life, and that's an important one. Now, also, we can do a couple things. We can fly less. Again, use it in this way. The average person uses or creates about 2 to 3 tons of carbon dioxide per year. And that's per flight. But if you did everything else in life, drove your car, a truck, rode a bus, a subway, you're using about 19 tons. But one airplane trip from New York to L.A. is 2 to 3 tons. So the less you fly, the greater the saving of the environment. Those are the things we can do. Now, but I also believe that we must look at all the things we're consuming and the idea that our society is based upon constant growth model. Why should we always be buying things when we don't use most of what we buy for any period of time and there's obsolescence built into everything? We throw stuff away. Why do we buy things we frequently cannot afford and end up with debts that then we pay usurious interest rates on? And payday loans is 400, 500, 600%. And then if you don't pay them, you end up in debtor's prison, something we thought were gone by the late 1800s. Not so. They're back today. We also should consider the footprint that we live and the footprint that we create by all that we consume. And then that would make a difference as well. So going to a plant-based diet, restricting wherever possible our travel, trying to buy things that are grown locally, organically, and not buying things we don't need, and also trying to stay away from buying, wherever possible, wood, because palm oil and wood and soy and cattle are the 4 largest reasons that we're having deforestation. So when you're not buying your genetically engineered soy, which is fed to cattle, and they're not clearing giant rainforest areas to grow cattle for an ever-increasing population, then shouldn't we be encouraging people in India and China to advocate for a plant-based diet for all the right reasons instead of encouraging them to emulate the American appetite for meat and fast foods, and with it, disease and destruction of the planet? So those are some ways that we can make a difference with our health and our environment. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a brief break. Come back with our guests. Please stay with us.
Love is in the air, everywhere I look around. Love is in the air, every sight and every sound. And I don't know if I'm being foolish, don't know if I'm being wise, but it's something that I must believe in, and it's there when I look in your eyes. Love is in the air, in the whisper of the tree.
For all of you listening all over the world, thank you for coming on board today, and we're going to go now to Santa Barbara, California. We're standing by as Professor William Robinson. He is the professor of sociology at the University of California at Santa Barbara. He is also the university's faculty of Latin American Studies and in the Global and International Studies program. And he is a scholar activist, deeply involved in American domestic and third world struggles for social justice and popular empowerment of populations and participatory democracy and government. And his areas of focus include globalization and transnationalism and political economics, migration. And he is the author of Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity. And his website is soc.uscb.edu/faculty/Robinson. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Your recent efforts at a sabbatical, extended sabbatical, where you left the university to travel throughout the major continents to witness the effects of neoliberal capitalism on poorer populations. And in your analysis, our current model of global capitalism has become systemic. And in the past, other staunch critics of corporate capitalism and economic greed, such as Naomi Klein and Anthony Lowenstein and Gary Leach and the late Sheldon Wolin, and others who have been on this program speaking about disaster capitalism, the emergence of a new totalitarianism built upon the capital of the financial elite, or what you would call the transnational capitalist class. So could you begin, please, by sharing some of your firsthand observations in your travel that indicate that global society has moved into a new era of social apartheid? And for what reasons might we consider this unprecedented inequality as sadistic? The form is yours.
Right. Well, I had the year to travel around the world, and I was in several countries in Latin America, several countries in Africa, North Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. And everywhere, Gary, the story is the same. Everywhere, tensions are reaching explosive dimensions. I mean, wars have broken out, social conflicts, political and social upheavals. And everywhere, you see the same structural telltale signs of a global capitalism in crisis and out of control, and elites that really have no response whatsoever to the crisis. So I came back and started thinking, well, you know, we've seen this in earlier moments in history, and what we're seeing different, and, you know, I coined that term sadistic capitalism, because for a long time now we've spoken of savage capitalism, a capitalism, and here we're talking, of course, about a global capitalism, not a particular country, but the whole system. And sadistic capitalism is one in which poverty and inequality are extremely sharp. There's militarization, racism, needless material deprivation, ecological destruction, and so forth. And so we are living in a global savage capitalism, which is in deep crisis, and I do want to talk about the crisis. But I also added that term sadistic capitalism because what I saw around the world is that these crisis dimensions, this inequality, this militarism, this ecological destruction itself, transnational capitalist class have taken these things and turned them into something to make even further profit with. To continue to accumulate capital. And a couple of examples that I want to give is turning poverty into a source of leisure and a source of entertainment and amusement for the global wealthy and the global affluent. So the, you know, example that my article starts out with is in South Africa. There is a company, and this is a transnational corporation, Emery Luxury Hotel and Spa Company, and they've gone into the shanty towns, and they've reconstructed a fake shanty town in South Africa. And we talk about a shanty town. We're talking about tin and wooden structure that you can barely live in, with a dirt floor and no plumbing, no indoor water, no heat, no cooling. You know, people live in incredible material deprivation in these massive shanty towns throughout the third world. And so they've created a fake shanty town. From the outside, it looks exactly like these shacks. And it's in the middle of the shanty town. It's just protected by big security walls and so forth. And here, the wealthy can go and have this experience. I'll even read from the online brochure. It says, The resort advertised an opportunity for tourists to stay in our unique shanty town and experience the traditional township living within a safe private game reserve environment. And it goes on, a cluster of simulated shanty towns outside of Bloemfontein that the company has constructed is ideal for team building, brace, bachelor parties, theme parks, and the experience of a lifetime. And then it went on to say the luxury accommodations made to appear from the outside as shacks featured paraffin lamps, candles, a battery-operated radio, an outside toilet, a drum and a fireplace for cooking, as well as underfloor heating, air conditioning, and wireless internet access. And then the picture that goes together with this advertisement is a well, you know, really fancy-dressed white couple embracing and in this field with the corrugated tin shanties in the background. So, you know, when you look at this, you say, gosh, the incredible deprivation of the people that live in the shanty towns in South Africa and by extension throughout the world, third world, is not just this savage reflection of savage capitalism, but it becomes the suffering and deprivation becomes a source of aesthetic pleasure, leisure and entertainment for the world's affluent. And so you see similar scenes all around the world where I went. You see similar scenes. And so really we're going even beyond the global savage capitalism to this sadistic, really what I call sadistic capitalism, where the dimensions of crisis itself become entertainment and become a spectacle. Another example, and this term I did not coin myself, others have spoken about it, is militainment, in which wars and the incredible destruction and human suffering of wars become entertainment through, whether it's through Hollywood movies that are then transmitted all around the world in this age of information technology and the internet, or whether it's through the nightly news, and of course we put the word term news in quotes, it's not really news, in which you see some horrible scenes and get some, and it's almost, you know, it's entertainment more than it is news. So that's what I mean by sadistic capitalism. Now, of course, the larger story here is a global capitalism in a crisis, which is simply unprecedented. This is not like earlier structural crises of global capitalism.
I appreciate that overview. I was not aware of that. That's just horrifying. It is so. It is economic condescension, in that it is showing that we will profit from your suffering, but we will not help you with your suffering. It's who in their right mind, who has any spiritual connection, would ever want to live in a shack, in the middle of shacks, to so they can be hip enough to experience something but not really experience it, and not, you know, the next day they get up and they have water to drink that's clean, they have food to eat that's plentiful, and they have air conditioned. It's just, it shows the deprivation which we've reached. Now, one development I'd like you to expand upon is the emergence of what I call in the United States green zones. I see in the upcoming next 5 years a substantial collapse in the United States' different economies, where people who are wealthy and will be able to live in luxury and be protected, and those who are not wealthy will be deprived substantially, and therefore will have to do for themselves. And yet this is not relegated to the United States. They're for transnational capitalist elite and those who are employed in their operations, we witness continually two separate laws in this country. There are laws for the oligarchy, and then there are laws for everyone else. Ergo, bankers who are charged with fraud and corruption to seek get a free pass, never go to jail, and their firms, such as the recent case of Goldman Sachs, gets fined, usually smaller, far smaller than the degree of the criminal activity, and they get to keep their ill-gotten gains, even get bonuses, and no one goes to jail. Then everyone else, there is a militarized private incarceration apparatus in place that benefits from imprisoning citizens for minor misdemeanors and keeps them increasing in debt. And if you cannot pay your debt, you go to jail. Then in jail, you're incurring more debt, so it's a vicious cycle. And now we're witnessing the physical landscape of cities and regions being divided to continue this class warfare. So please describe these new green zones, and in terms of our race towards a more totalitarian corporate state, what is this green zone development really indicative of?
Right. Yes. Yeah. Crucial question. I agree with everything you said, and let me expand a bit on it. And for the listeners that are not familiar, maybe the younger listeners, that the term green zone originally comes from the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. And the U.S. invaders zoned off with these massive walls with guard towers and electricity. I mean, basically impenetrable area in the center of Baghdad. And inside were the U.S. occupation forces, the administrators and the technicians, along with the soldiers and the, you know, the officials, the officers themselves. And inside was the Iraqi elite. And they were impenetrable. And beyond, and outside of that green zone was this unbelievable destruction, you know, war and bombs and absolute misery. And so that's the origin of green zones. But what you're pointing out completely correctly is that we now have green zones in the United States, and but more generally, the whole planet is becoming these areas of global green zones inside which the 1% that you're making reference to, the Goldman Sachs officers, but also 20% of humanity. So allow me to just mention that, you know, the larger structural context is that we've never seen at a worldwide level such unprecedented inequality. And everyone talks about the 1%, and that's absolutely important. In fact, the Oxfam Development Report, the most recent one released just this past January, said that there's 66 multi-billionaires in the world that have more wealth than 50% of humanity. I mean, it's mind-boggling. 66 people have more wealth than 3.5 billion people. But beyond, and so that's grabbed the headlines, and that is very significant. But beyond that, world society, this is all over. This is each country in the world and the whole, you know, global system. The division is between some 20% of humanity, which is more affluent, which can flourish under the new global capitalist system, and 80% of humanity that experiences destabilization and downward mobility, and insecurity and so forth. And so that's the, you know, a very significant divide, the 20-80% global social apartheid. And so that 20% increasingly occupies the world's global green zones. And we see this pattern, the original model of Iraq, spread throughout the world, in which the 20% is surrounded by armies of private security guards and the walls that you mentioned, and different laws, different sets of laws, different ways that the state treats repression of the 80% and accommodation of the 20% and so forth and so on. But when you travel around the world, which I had the extreme privilege of doing, I mean, honestly, I'm in the 20% in terms of, you know, income and ability to live in this world. You see these global green zones everywhere. So in Cairo, for instance, Cairo is, you know, reeling after the Arab Spring failed to dislodge the dictatorial system. You see that back, and you see inequality as well as poverty and downward mobility is intensifying in Egypt. The country's in crisis. And yet the elite, the Egyptian elite, more than just that 1%, are, you know, are living in heaven. And so we went to these suburbs, satellite cities, really, outside of Cairo. They've fled the poor zones. And in these satellite cities, they have residential complexes. You can only get in when you get past military guards. So you see the role of the state and the military force in protecting these green zones. And inside, they have spotless green lawns. It looks like wealthy Southern California areas, and they're in the desert. They have these leisure centers and shopping centers, English language international schools where their kids go to, and there's military checkpoints and police everywhere. So they're living in their own world. Of course, they're not, because they're sucking all of that wealth and privilege and power from the masses of Egyptians that are relegated to the most miserable conditions you can imagine. Then, of course, you go to Palestine. I was there, too. And Palestine, because each of these green zones all around the world have their own particular characteristics, but you see the same pattern. So in Palestine, of course, you have the Palestinian population lives in what's basically a giant open air prison, and there's the actual real wall, the real actual wall, all around the Palestinian communities, Jewish only settler roads, the ubiquitous military occupation. So really, Palestine's one giant green zone alongside the a prison. But so wherever you go, I mean, you can go around the world and you see this new restructuring of space and restructure and the rise of very frightening new social security systems to maintain this spatial division of the world. And, you know, information technology allows those in these global green zones to work, to shop, to communicate with one another across the globe. And again, I want to emphasize that this goes together with these frightening new systems of social control and systems of repression. You mentioned some of it, you know, the systems of mass incarceration, two different legal norms for the two different populations. You know, everywhere you see that technology has developed where social control is now all ubiquitous. In some places it's low-key and you don't even see it until it comes into action. In other places, you're talking like, you know, Palestine and Egypt, you're talking about, you know, armies everywhere. So this is the new global apartheid we live in, and global green zoning.
Could you further expand upon the idea of surplus of human population and how a different kind of social and political control is being created to manage this surplus, a social control that would not necessarily apply to the rest of the global population that is discerned as productive because it furthers the oligarchos' agenda. And as you write, global capitalism has no use for surplus humanity. Therefore, what does it serve? And should we therefore be concerned with the ways capitalist regimes might find to exterminate this surplus altogether.
Yes. Yeah. Again, a crucial dimension of what I continue to insist is not just the old world capitalism with all of its misery and dangers that we're familiar with, but really a more intensified crisis and a transformation into this new globalized capitalism. So one of the things that's going on, I mentioned the division of the world into the 20-80% in terms of the distribution of income and resources, and then, of course, power, state power. But the other thing that's going on is that there is a portion of humanity, which I refer to now as surplus humanity, a portion of humanity that's been pushed out of the productive economy, dispossessed, whether it's of land or whether it's of previous jobs or wherever it is, and pushed into the margins of global society, and with no direct incorporation or use that the system has for this surplus humanity. And when you look at the, you know, the data we're talking about, if you look country-wise, we're talking about between, 15-20% up to 60-70% of the population in some countries. And in global society as a whole, we're talking about 30% to 30-35% of humanity. And so the system has a problem. How do you maintain the explosive contradictions of the system where 30-35% of humanity is simply locked out, surplus humanity? So this leads to these incredible systems of repression and the reorganization of space and wars around the world. But let me go into a little detail of something. The significance here is that if you have 30-35% of humanity becomes surplus. And, Marx used to write about the Industrial Reserve Army, and he was referring to 70% of the population. 5-7% is unemployed for long periods of time, right? That's what we used to talk about. But this is 35-40% in some countries, again, 50-70%. And so the dominant groups, the powers that be and the states that represent the interests of global capitalism have the problem of how do you exercise social control over this potentially explosive population on the one hand. And so you have the new systems of social control and of repression and wars and mass policing and incarceration system and immigrant detention systems. But on the other hand, and this is the other flip dimension to this, it means that if 3 to 4 out of every 10 people that are structurally unemployed forever and locked out, the other people that are employed are going to accept lower wages. They're going to accept the conditions of what we're now calling precariatization. What we mean by precariatization is you are the proletariat. That's the P part of it, and then you're existing in precarious conditions, not the old stable conditions of tenured or year round employment, but informalized work, outsourced work, extreme low salary work, insecure work where you might only have it for a few weeks out of the year, contract labor, and so forth and so on. And this type of neoliberal precariat is expanding too. But if 30 to 40% of humanity is surplus, those that are actually able to work and slightly get by in the global capitalist system are subject to these pressures where they their demands and their organizing and so forth is very tenuous because there's some surplus humanity right next door. Now, the other thing that's very important to notice that the surplus humanity allows for the reintroduction of slave systems around the world. And that's no exaggeration to talk about the new 21st century slavery. And you see it everywhere. For instance, we all have cell phones and we don't all have it, but a portion of humanity now has at a mass level has cell phones and computers, and those have the minerals in them. And a significant amount of those minerals, there's some key ingredients in them, come from the Congo. We all know this. I mean, we talk about diamonds in the Congo, but it's much more than that. More significantly, I forgot the name of it. It's not cobalt, but coban. I forgot the particular name of the substance that goes into every single cell phone and the computer. The computers, the laptops. And so we know that there is a war in the Congo where some 5 to 6 million people have already died. It's not a conventional war. There's not two specific warring sides. And we know that there's slave labor used extensively. There are warlords, which represent the militarized, local elites in the Congo, who round up slave labor to get these minerals. They then deliver them to the transnational corporations that can wipe their hands clean and say, it's not us. It's, going on inside internally to the Congo. We don't control it. And so that's one example of a system of slave labor made possible by this restructuring, by this global integration, and by surplus humanity. There's examples all over. There's the sweatshops in China and Bangladesh, and of course, anniversary just passed of some 2 million women died in that fire in Bangladesh. There's the use all around the world now of transnational immigrant labor, which is super exploited and super repressed. We talk about the immigrant rights movement in the United States and the attack on and scapegoating of immigrants, but this is a worldwide phenomenon. We talk about what's going on with the Syrian and, you know, and Iraqi refugees and Middle Eastern refugees pouring into Europe and subject to the most hard conditions imaginable. So all of this is surplus humanity, and all of this is these new systems of social control, but also it's the system taking advantage of surplus humanity to have new forms of slave labor, super exploited transnational immigrant labor around the world. And it also legitimates the imposition in general of these new systems of social controlling, including surveillance, including policing, including the restructuring of space. And, you know, those that in that 20% of humanity, affluent 20%, then come to accept this. We don't even question anymore that basically every airport in the world is militarized and Patriot Acts are now in every, you know, country in the world. So, I mean, I could go on and on, but this is some of the dimensions of this new globalized capitalism. And again, I had the privilege of traveling around the world and seeing how in each country, each region, you see these same patterns.
Okay, that was a very interesting insight. I know that you're familiar with, or I assume you're familiar with, Professor Sheldon Wolin's model that the U.S. is currently a nation that can best be described as inverted totalitarianism. And as Wolin describes it, this is a totalitarianism that is new and unique in global civilization. When you think of totalitarianism and fascism, you think of dictatorial regimes such as Nazi Germany, Stalin's Soviet Union, or Italy under Mussolini. And yet in these tyrannical regimes, political-controlled economies, in American totalitarianism, economics controls politics. And I think this should be clear for anyone whose eyes are open to how private interests rule over Washington. And also, this means of social control are different. While both forms of fascism similarly control the media and propaganda, in classic fascism, there is an emphasis upon inspiring the citizenry towards nationalism and national productivity. In inverted totalitarianism, according to Wolin and folks like Chris Hedges, and this is perhaps a little more difficult for many people to grasp, the goal was to keep the citizenry apathetic, entertained, and to propagandize them to the illusion that they are directly participating in a democracy, when in fact it's all ritual and spectacle with little meaning. And in that sense, I read an article today about how Hillary helped ruin Haiti and how she and her State Department would not allow the person who would now be president of Haiti, Dr. Mirlandi Manigat, who is graduated from the Sorbonne, who was a leftist who wanted to do more to help the people of Haiti and did not like the NGOs going into Haiti. And the State Department and Hillary made sure that she did not win. And then that's one example of how you control a whole nation and then put your people in place. And then I read another article by Robert Hunziker today about Greece's lost soul, about how Greece now is suffering. It's being completely privatized, and its citizens are being thrown into dire poverty. Their pensions are being reduced. Their unemployment rate is skyrocketing. And they're told, you can only be helped if you continue to allow us to privatize you, to exploit you. And all the while, the people benefiting are this the global elite, Goldman Sachs, for example, and the debt that they have is more of the banker's debt that could be written off. They could leave the Eurozone. They could say goodbye to this debt. They could join with countries, including Russia, India, Brazil, and others, that would support them and trade with them, and yet they're not doing it because their leadership has been compromised so that Greek people are really in trouble. And again, behind this are the globalists. Behind this are the Business Roundtable and the Council on Foreign Relations, and they're never mentioned by the New York Times or the other media as complicit in this. Your thoughts, please.
Yes. Well, I agree with all of that. Let me just expand a little bit on it with some other dimensions of what you're referring to. Yes, I inverted totalitarianism. I completely agree with that analysis. The term I use is 21st century fascism, but we're looking at the same things going on. And really, we're living under a dictatorship of transnational capital, a worldwide dictatorship, and a dictatorship of transnational capital in the United States. But the nature of this dictatorship, as inverted totalitarianism refers to, or my notion of 21st century fascism, is a little different. And I think there's two types of power which is operating, which allows us to be moving into this inverted totalitarianism or this new type of fascism. And one is what we refer to as the structural power of transnational capital. What I mean by that is that capital previously in the 20th century and prior to that was at a nation state based level. And so working classes, popular classes, the poor, the marginalized could struggle at the level of the nation state and force some type of constraints, however minimum, on capital in the nation state, on capital in the elite, and force states to do some regulation of capital, some redistribution downward of wealth and resources. I mean, that's the story around the world of the rise of that type of capitalism, New Deal capitalism, for instance. But capital went global in the late 20th century. It broke free of constraints at the nation-state level. And so that's given capital this new structural power over peoples everywhere on the planet. And so the example you used of Greece is really the model example right now, the case study right now of what's going on really in every country. We know that economic power, we can't have democracy as long as there's the incredible concentration of economic resources and economic power. And that economic power translates into political control. In one country, it means that the economically dominant groups put the military in power and have direct, coercive control and dictatorships. In another country, like the United States or Greece, it means that economic power controls political elections and processes. That's the United States. Or a third country like Greece is, even when you do elect a leftist government, the Syriza government in Greece, that transnational economic power, this dictatorship of transnational capital, can still impose the political conditions and the social order from without, from the whole global system. So you have this heightened structural power of transnational capital at every level, and that's part of what leads us to inverted totalitarianism or 21st century capitalism. Now, the other instrument the dominant groups use that you also alluded to is the heightened level of ideological and cultural control, or what we can call the culture industries and the ideological apparatus, which is not just the state but the dominant groups. And this heightened level of cultural and ideological control is unbelievably more sophisticated and ubiquitous. I mean, the manipulation of desire through consumerism and the manipulation of libido through the culture industries and ideological apparatus. As you said, what we're really seeing is the colonization or the attempt to colonize our minds, to make it impossible to even think critically. And, Gary, maybe most of us, myself included, were too young to actually, be adults in World War II. But you might remember that there was someone resisting, I forgot his name, the Nazis. And he had a famous phrase that everyone used to say back in the mid-20th century, "I think as I please," which meant, you can kill us, you can control through military the system, you can do whatever you want to our bodies, but inside our minds we think as we please. We can reject you and we can think how we want to resist you. But increasingly, most people can't or don't think as they please because these sophisticated cultural and ideological processes going together with the structural power of transnational capital and the repressive power of the state have colonized our minds in so many ways that many people, either we are lulled into passivity and to indifference, if we're not literally in a war like in Syria and Iraq where we can't, or sitting in the mass incarceration system in the United States, we're lulled into passivity or complacency, or even when we try and break free of this mental or ideological cultural colonization, the types of resistance that don't fully grasp the dimension of what we're facing and the type of transformation we need. I mean, the idea here is to suppress any possible images of a utopia or of a way out of the system, so that there's just everything is within the system. So it truly is a totalitarianism. It's the notion of totalitarianism. There's no way out. There's nothing outside of the system. I know we're just about running out of time, but I don't want it to be too pessimistic. The other thing that I saw moving all around the world is that everywhere, and we all know this, those who follow the news, there's a global revolt underway. Everywhere you go, the elites, the dominant groups, the 1% cannot contain these incredible contradictions of global capitalism, and so there are mass uprisings everywhere. And of course, the global revolt faces many challenges. What type of a transformative project can we actually viably carry through? And there's a lot of lessons there in Greece. How can we transnationalize our struggles? Because success in any one country will not be successful if it's not linked to success elsewhere. And so there's a whole lot of hope, and there's these burgeoning social movements, as I mentioned, a global revolt everywhere in the world. And so the question is, where do we go with this? How do we link it all up? You know, how do we actually fundamentally challenge the nature of this beast that we face?
Well, I think that that's a great place to end, and I look forward to another conversation to continue our dialogue.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you very much for having me on your program.
Professor William Robinson from Santa Barbara. He's professor of sociology, University of California, Santa Barbara. He is the author of Global Capitalism and the Crisis of Humanity. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.